Nick Hort, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today. As we were just catching up before I hit the record button, we're always interested to get people, you know, onto the podcast who are actual practitioners, people who have no sort of worked in the jobs that we're talking about. We don't want to hear from no sort of consultants telling us what's wrong with the asset recovery sector who haven't actually, you know, been in the weeds. So being able to get folks that have actually and are still currently working in law enforcement roles, and particularly with your interest and background, I'm very, very grateful for you taking the time.
No worries at all. It's good to be on. Hopefully it can be useful for you.
No, listen, I've no doubt it will. And I think I can't even take the credit for this suggestion. You had said to me beforehand, should we talk about what Interpol actually is? And I think that would be the best place to kick off. And obviously weave in your story and what got you to this sort of sitting there today. But it is true. I think so many people are afraid and they just knowingly nod when they hear someone mention Interpol and Europol and they coordination and investigation and stuff like that. But I would love to hear from you about what Interpol does.
It's a really good question. It's the first thing we should talk about for sure. So I guess my background is I'm a City of London police officer, so I'm seconded out here, and I've been a detective for most of my career, and I've been in economic crime for most of that period as a detective. And I think the first time that I wish I'd known what Interpol did, and when I didn't know, was when I had an international investigation. I think from memory, it was a fraud. It had links to the US and to West Africa and to parts of Europe and also to the UK. And looking back now, I really wish I'd known more about Interpol. I really wish I'd used it, because I think I probably could have had a better impact on that investigation, given that there were suspects in other parts of the world. Okay. So the basics of Interpol is we're the only global law enforcement organization. So we have 196 member countries, which is big even by the standards of other international organizations. So the vast majority of countries in the world are members of Interpol. Given that we're going to talk about asset recovery and silver notices later, what's really important to say is each one of those has an office, one single office called a National Central Bureau. I'll call it an NCB throughout our discussion. Each one of those has an NCB. So there's 196 NCBs. They are the gateway for us and the gateway for other countries. So if for the sake of argument, the UK wants to share intelligence or information via Interpol channels with the US, that information goes out of the British NCB and it comes into the US NCB. It doesn't go through any of the channels. So it's not a means for a detective in one country to simply send an email to a detective in another country. So we've got that standard in place, which means that NCBs do all the work and are incredibly important in what we do. So that's how the countries fit in with us. The stuff we provide is, I guess, one is information sharing in general. We have an intelligence sharing system called I247. Each one of those NCBs has access to that, of course. And of course, we have access to it as well. And that is a secure means of sharing intelligence. And that means that a country can choose to share intelligence with us here in Lyon or our colleagues elsewhere in the world who work for Interpol, or they can share information with one other country or with 10 other countries or with all the other countries as they see fit. So that's the kind of the basic intelligence sharing. We also have notices. We'll come on to notices more later, but everyone would have heard of red notices, which are for people who are wanted for extradition. So if a country has a suspect for a crime, he or she is extraditable, and they think that he or she is abroad, then they have the ability to put on a red notice, which means that other countries have the ability to identify that person, perhaps when they are stopped in a car, or perhaps when they're arrested for a crime, or perhaps when they go through an airport or a seaport, and then they have the ability to either arrest them or at least to tell the requesting country where they are. So we've got notices, we've got information sharing, and then we do quite a lot of work as well in relation to building capacity, training. We know that there's lots and lots of training needs in a range of countries, so we do our best to help train police officers and other law enforcement officials in new and emerging types of crime or even basic types of investigation, and also we support cases, and that's, you know, as a career detective, that's the stuff that get the juices flowing a bit. You know, if a country comes to us and says, in fact, as I should have done maybe when I was a young detective, you know, if I'd have come from the UK to Interpol and said, look, I need a hand in the US, I need a hand in West Africa, I need a hand with these European countries, then Interpol would have, I'm quite sure, used its contacts, put me in touch with the right people, enabled me to work with the National Central Bureaus and facilitate that intelligence sharing, helped me to understand the laws and the various procedures, and hopefully ended up with me doing a better job of investigating. So, you know, that's the crux of what we do. You can imagine there's lots of other things, but we cover any organized crime that you can think of. We, you know, focus on financial crime here in this conversation, of course, but drug trafficking, firearms, crimes against children, human trafficking, environmental crime, whatever you can think of is essentially the kind of work that we're happy to help those member countries. We don't do the investigation. You know, they do. They do the hard yards. But our job is to support them, to help them in those sorts of ways.
So would it be fair to say it's that sort of international facilitation when you have, you know, you have those? Because I think that some people who, you know, come from this sector, you know, might be confused as, you know, so what is the difference, for example, from a practitioner's perspective, if I, like, when am I contacting, you know, something like an informal network, like a Karen network that sits at Europol versus an Interpol? Like, what's the difference, or what? And don't forget to tell us about your background.
Yeah, no, of course. I think it's a really good point. And again, we'll touch on it a bit more when we talk about the silver notice that we're going to discuss today. But one thing I'm really keen on saying is that we don't see ourselves as a rival, if you like. We don't see ourselves as better than others. Mm-hmm. I think what we offer is something slightly different. So the first thing is obviously global in nature, which means that if you know that a case has international links, but they are multi-regional, or you don't even know which countries are involved, or you don't know all of them, then obviously Interpol is a logical place to be.
And to come. Yeah, even just as part of the course. Scoping phase of the investigation, building it up.
100%. But also we've got really, really rigorous rules and procedures in place in relation to how we protect and store data and intelligence, and how long we store it for, and what the permissions around it are. And many networks are incredibly valuable, absolutely, but many of them are networks which help you to make the right contact in another country, but it doesn't necessarily then mean that you can share intelligence in a secure way, or that the intelligence could be secured, because, you know,
I sort of think of, like, scale and infrastructure as the big difference when I think Interpol versus an informal contact.
Well, I mean, we've got something like 70,000 red notices on our systems at any one time. So that is 70,000 records which are stored and are available at the touch of a button to police officers worldwide. So if I was back in uniform in London now, and I stopped someone in a car, and they happened to have a red note, Interpol red notice against their name, I would likely get that information instantly, and that would happen in many other countries. So the fact that information is always there is a massive selling point for us, because it's always stored. So it's not a one shot. If you come to Interpol for help, it doesn't necessarily mean that you only help us or you only ask for our help for that one day. That information could be stored within analytical files or within databases. We've got 19 databases with millions and millions of records of different types. I think that's the big difference, really.
That's very useful. What got you then into this world and sitting in Interpol today? You mentioned being a London police officer.
So I've been in the police in the UK initially as a civilian for a few years, but then as a police officer for more years than I care to remember. I think 2002 was when it all started. But as I said, I was a detective in the City of London Police for most of my career. You and many of the people listening, I guess, will know that the City of London Police has historically had a really important part to play in the UK in relation to economic crime investigations, especially fraud, but now cyber investigations as well. So most of my detective career was spent investigating cases which were national in nature. And by definition, especially in fraud, almost every case was also international in nature. So I was really fortunate. You know, I was traveling up and down the country, conducting investigations or supporting other people's investigations, seeing that national element, but also increasingly seeing the links internationally. So quite a lot of work with Europol in relation to intellectual property crime, for instance, quite a lot of bilateral work. We had really good engagement with some of the people working out of foreign embassies in London. So I guess the international element was always there. And, you know, if we're being totally honest, the opportunity to come out to Interpol arose, and from a professional point of view, but also from a personal point of view, as you can imagine, it's a phenomenal opportunity to come out. You know, I'm talking to you from Lyon in France, which is a fantastic city. So, you know, a great place to be personally, a great place to be professionally, but also I believe, and I hope that those listening, if they're listening from the City of London, would agree that actually it's valuable for the UK for me to be out here as well, because my focus here is on financial crime and corruption. The UK is pretty focused on trying to do a better job in relation to those crime areas, and also is very, very aware and has the data to back it up that the majority of the threat to the UK is international in nature. So I'm here. I'm British, and I'm British seconded official. I'm not here to support the UK. I'm here to support 196 countries. But I think naturally, I'd like to think the UK gets a benefit as well from the fact that I'm present out here. And my current role, which I guess I should have done right at the start, which I didn't, was assistant director in our Financial Crime and Anti-Corruption Centre. So I'm fortunate enough to be one of the managers in this field for Interpol.
Well, look, we've had the pleasure of our sort of paths sort of crossing over a number of initiatives over the years in public and private sector collaborations. And I think that, I mean, it is that interesting, sir, and we'll get on to the notices, but it is that interesting, like, the segmentation, I mean, financial crime and sort of corruption, tackling anti-corruption, you talked about economic crime, you talked about fraud. I mean, is there, from your view, because obviously you have this really unique perspective now, seeing this sort of international lens in cases, do you think sometimes there's too much attempts to segment cases, or is it just an understanding the sort of the modus operandi, or it's about statistical collection of information? But I mean, my co-founder in Asset Reality, Nick, you know, his book was famously, there's no such thing as crypto crime, because he used to get frustrated at the constant just pigeonholing of cases. And I mean, I can't separate, I mean, if there's corruption cases, there's always a financial element. If there's no corruption and financial, then there's crimes being committed. Like, how do you think about that? Sort of like, what's the where does narcotics not come into that, because there's usually a financial, but how does Interpol, because I know that domestically most countries struggle with sort of segmentation and boundaries, and when's it a cyber case and when's it a crypto case? I mean, you must see a lot of that.
I think it's a really good question. I think when I started as a detective, I guess you would say that quite a lot of financial crime, for instance, was cyber enabled. The statistics now are going to be, you know, far higher. It's going to be the vast majority are cyber enabled. And I look back to, for instance, you mentioned crypto. I look back, for instance, to when I actually started out in policing as an analyst. I was looking at really local crime. I was looking at lots and lots of car crime and lots of burglaries. And it got me thinking that, you know, what would we call a vehicle crime now? Would we say it's theft from a vehicle or theft of a vehicle? Or would we say it's any crime involving a vehicle? So, you know, a robbery suspect leaves in a vehicle, or a burglary suspect arrives in a vehicle, or a murder suspect travels to the scene in a vehicle. Does that all count as vehicle crime? So I think you're right that we probably try to put too many labels on crimes, I guess. And it's not easy. You need to have specialists. You need to have people who know, you know, what they're doing in a certain area. One of the things we're trying to do here, and we're being increasingly successful at it, is understanding that there is a financial element to virtually every crime that Interpol is involved in helping our countries to investigate. So we have a number of people based in other parts of the business. You know, we've got a colleague who's a financial crime expert in the cybercrime team. We've got one in the environmental crime team. We've got one in the human trafficking team. We're working really hard to make sure that we've got one in the drugs unit, but we work really well with the drugs unit in any case. So I think, as I said, we understand, it's not rocket science, of course. It's not pretending that we understand it and no one else does, but we understand that virtually every crime has that financial element. And we seek, in respect to money laundering, in respect to asset recovery, to try to help any country with any type of crime, because we recognize, and in fact we've had some real success helping countries where, for instance, in environmental crime, following the, you know, the illegally logged timber, for example, is really hard. But actually identifying the people involved in the laundering of the proceeds of that is more straightforward and is often a better way to get people locked up. So that's the kind of thing that we try to promote consistently, which is, you know, following the money, as we've heard of before, and conducting those financial investigations. So yeah, I think it's a challenge. No one's got it. No one's got the answer perfect, I think, but we're trying to do our best to help.
It's almost like we just need to have a new sort of global standardization, which again is never going to be possible. But like a global standardization of almost like just no emerging technologies. Like we wouldn't have an internet department anymore in government. And I think that sometimes we see that with digital assets, or as you say, with anti-corruption. I always look. I understand if it's such a problem in a particular jurisdiction, it's quite right then to mobilize, you know, a very specific team with a very specific mandate. But yeah, thanks for your insights on that. You'd also mentioned then that, and I think anecdotally from the exposure that I've had to Interpol, just as a viewer on the sidelines, to be absolutely clear, it is that sort of top-down, no sharing of best practice and information. As you say, someone might be investigating a case in a particular way, but you can help them achieve the same goals by saying, well, have you thought about it this way? And maybe you can't catch this coordinator, like you say, through a paper trail with logistics, but you'll find the bankers. And you'll find that if you can sort of lean us in then to this position that Interpol had sitting on the tens of thousands, as you mentioned, of requests you must regularly get because of red notices. I mean, where did the concept come from in terms of, right, we actually need to do this for assets? Because as you said, virtually every crime, bar a crime of passion, has a financial element. Even a crime of passion probably utilizes financial intelligence in arresting and identifying suspects. I would sort of propose that virtually every crime has an asset, either an asset to be seized or an asset to be seized in terms of disruption and deterrence effect, or an asset to be seized in terms of victim restitution, societal impact. What was the history to the silver notice sort of coming in to being, and what is the actual pilot, and what is the
role? I think we discussed it briefly before the recording went on. The history in terms of the strategic need is probably quite well known. There's a figure which is a bit old now, but the figure is that only 1% of criminal assets are ever recovered. It's probably impossible for anyone to say whether that's accurate, but certainly it's going to be the number will be low. We know that. So we've got this history of the fact that criminal assets generally stay in the hands of criminals, which means that as a group, private sector, public sector, law enforcement, policy, we're obviously not doing as well as we could do. You've got that element. I think you've then got the increasing nature and the ability of criminals to move assets from one jurisdiction to another. That's always been there, but it's becoming easier and easier, of course, over the last few years. And criminals, let's take a corruption case as an example. It would be unusual for a criminal to steal a significant amount of state assets and then to leave those assets in that same country, whether it's in a bank account in their family member's name, or if they buy a house with it, or whatever it might be. It would be far more normal for them to move it around. So A, the number of criminal assets or the proportion is far too high that stay in criminal hands, and B, the proportion that move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction is really high. And then I think you also have this challenge, and you mentioned it in your previous question a little bit, which is that there are specialist units domestically in most countries. There are also regional units as well, whose role is being a specialist in recovering assets. And the people in those units, one challenge they face is how hard it is to find assets overseas. Another one is then how hard it is, or how long it takes to get those assets back from overseas. And I guess a third one is really the level of resource it takes. It's difficult. And so if, again, I was never a a confiscator in the UK, but I worked with and alongside a large number of confiscators. And if I was investigating, or if they were investigating, a British criminal who had a huge amount of assets and they'd gone overseas, or some of them had, it would have been a really hard thing for them to do. They may have used some of those informal networks that you just suggested. They may have sent, you know, the name and the details of this suspect to colleagues in other countries to ask them if they had any awareness of him or her, whether they could make any searches, etc. But it was very much informal. So there was loads of, and there still are, by the way, lots and lots of challenges to recovering assets overseas. That's, I guess, the kind of the strategic landscape. The way that the Silver Notice came into being was really the brainchild of colleagues in Italy, let's be honest. Italy's got a fantastic history of following the money, and they really were at the forefront of doing this in respect to their mafia investigations, because they realized quite early that one of the ways to disrupt the most serious mafia criminals was by following their money and trying to recover the assets. And they've done some phenomenal work in turning some of those assets into public good. You know, they've got buildings that used to be owned by the mafia that are now there and serving the public. So they've got a great reputation and a great history in this. So Italy really came to us and said, we believe that there's a need for a new Interpol notice that targets assets. And if I just, and by the way, if I rewind a little bit, there up until that point, there's been no Interpol notice about assets. The Interpol notices tend to be about people or about crime types. You know, a purple notice, for instance, gives us ideas of how new modus operandi have been identified in certain countries. So there wasn't a notice about assets. And what we did was we got this group of experts together from more than 30 countries, and we said to them, look, what more can we do in this space in response to this call from Italy? And what they said to us really was the idea of a new notice, something which could be received by those NCBs that I mentioned before, and that could be assessed instantly as something which relates to assets, which means that the NCBs either do searches themselves or they pass them on to their expert colleagues elsewhere in the country, whether it's an asset recovery agency or a financial intelligence unit or what have you. What they said was, if you can design this new notice and if you can thereby enable us as investigators to share information on assets which we're looking to trace or to identify, etc., then that will really help us out. So really that's the genesis of the pilot. It's been a long road. It's been a challenging road. It's not an easy thing to do at all. You know, lots of hurdles that we've overcome, but you know, we can go on to it in a second, but the pilot started in January this year. And you know, strongly believe it's having a positive impact already.
No, it's an interesting segue, or it's not an interesting segue, an interesting connection. And we didn't discuss this beforehand, that our next guest on the podcast is an FT journalist, Miles Johnson. And Miles wrote the book Chasing Shadows, and it's actually about the story of Salvatore Petito, I think it is. And it's I was actually going to ask you about that. And it was about the interconnectivity between all of these different, you know, money laundering systems. And it's like, you've got the cartels and, you know, they're very good at logistics, and you've got maybe the, you know, the Russian sort of cyber launderer, and they're really good at Russian cyber sort of gangs, and they're good at laundering. And it was this, how this all operated, almost like startup ecosystems. And he actually talks about that, and obviously talks about the Italian response. And actually, sort of fun fact, you know, in Asset Reality EU, we're actually registered in Italy, and that's because of my relationship with asset recovery. And it's exactly to your point, you know, I mean, the early anti-mafia legislation, the social reuse of assets, some of the novel ways, Operation Payback, some of the things. When I first got involved with sort of EU, I think it's DG Home at the European Commission, it was always the Italian stories. And I think they've just like all jurisdictions, they've had incredible challenges. But I do think, as you say, there was that progressive, they had to deal with it and they had to do something. So that was I didn't actually know that they were one of the sort of driving forces behind that. So what does good look like? So let's say pilot goes well, 50 odd countries signed up to the pilot, people are putting in their requests and saying, hey, I've got a I mean, one of our sort of well-known partners, a government is in the middle of one of the biggest sort of corruption cases in the world at the minute, tackling that. So let's say they contact your contact Interpol and they say, we've started this investigation. Yep. We've got a global freezing order. We yep. need help. No yep. finding assets. What sure. happens next from a sort of practitioner's yep, no,
that's
point
a,
of view?
I mean, that's a great question. Important, I think, because of the audience that we're, you know, hopefully talking to today. So
hopefully it's not just us. Yeah, it's my dad tuned in. I think that's a bit ahead of it.
But let's hope there's more than just the two of more us. More than one. Dad, yeah. So as I said, let's start from the beginning. You've got. At the moment, there are 51 countries who have asked us to be involved in the pilot. That pilot is running for the whole of this year. I hope that it will last longer than that. There's no confirmation, but that's my strong hope. So 51 countries can take part in the pilot. And what that means they can do is their national central bureaus can send a silver notice or a silver diffusion. And the difference is important. Let's say I'm the suspect. Let's say I've been convicted of an offence and I have a confiscation order against me for the value of 10 million euros. And the investigators have only found 1 million of those euros and they think the other nine are somewhere overseas. They've got two options. Number one is that they can complete a silver notice template, which gives all the details of the crime and, you know, what my involvement in it is, etc. And that can be sent as a notice to the whole world. So it goes to 196 countries, well, 195 plus the receiving one. Or they can complete a diffusion, which is very, very similar, but it means they get to choose which countries to send it to. And for instance, if they believe that all of my assets are likely to be in one certain region of the world, they may choose to only send it to that region. Or if there are some geopolitical differences between countries and they don't want to share intelligence with some others, then they don't have to share it with those others. Yeah. They'll share it with the diffusion.
You can be selective. You don't have to broadcast everybody.
So the investigator, and maybe there's one or two listening to this, the investigator will say, well, I've got this criminal. We've done a very, you know, reasonable level of investigation. We're not talking about this as a fishing expedition. This isn't the first thing an investigator does. But let's say that the investigator has a court order which says you can search for or you can seize assets and they believe those assets are abroad. They can get hold of their National Central Bureau if they're within the 51 countries and they can say, I want your help to fill in this silver notice or silver diffusion template. That's a process which could be done relatively quickly. And then we here at Interpol put those through some pretty stringent checks. We've got a team of people who confirm that every request that comes to us is within in line of our rules, because for instance we don't permit Interpol channels to be used for anything which is military in nature or political in nature or religious or racial, etc. So we'll do some checks, we'll make sure that the notice or the diffusion is in line with our procedures, and then we will send it out, and it'll either go, as I said, to the whole world or just to the countries that have been asked. And then step two, which is really important, is that the countries who receive it then take some action, we hope. Interpol does not mandate countries to do anything. Domestic legislation, domestic law has total primacy. So we're not going to tell anyone what to do. But our hope is that the countries who receive those documents, those notices or diffusions, will identify the best checks that they could undertake. So perhaps they've got a unit with access to the register of companies or businesses. Maybe they've got access to the register of vehicle ownership, and they can maybe identify an expensive car. Maybe the same with boats or with yachts, maybe with property. Maybe they've got the ability to check whether there are any bank accounts in that person's name, or whether there's any criminal intelligence, which links that person to the country. And if they do those checks, and if they identify that, yes, Nick Court has got some financial footprint in my country, what we then ask is that they go back to the sender and they say, yes, we've got a potential link here. What's really, really important to say is that the notice or diffusion is not a freezing order. It, you know, in the same way that a red notice is not an arrest warrant, despite what some of the newspapers may say, it's a request for information, and the countries, we hope that they go back, they say, yes, we found some information, and then they work bilaterally. And if there's any prosecutors listening to this, they may be you know, breathing a sigh of relief. We're not trying to jump in the way of mutual legal assistance. That has primacy. What we're trying to do is to, as you said, just gather information that gives people a starting point to say, yes, okay, some of that, those 9 million of assets of Nick Corp, which I haven't found, are likely to be in this country. And then you can start the process of getting those back, which obviously is not quick, but we hope that the Silver Notice or diffusion starts the process and starts the ball rolling for them.
So would you expect, on a practical, appreciate there can be multitude of nuances here, but in normal circumstances, would I, as the investigator who has received this in the other jurisdiction, so I've got the information on my desk that says, have a look at Nick Court. I've looked at Nick Court and I've seen that there's potentially assets through intelligence that I have, through registers that I have access to. Am I then basically cooperating with my international counterpart to say, as a country, we're actually going to stand up our own freezing order to go and actually grab those assets, and then the normal asset sharing and all of those things sort of take over? Or is it a case of, and the answer might be both, or is it a case of getting that freezing order recognized in my jurisdiction?
Yeah, yeah.
Is there either?
As I said, the domestic legislation is what has primacy. So, for instance, some countries may be willing to say, yes, we found a house in this name, it's worth €1 million. And they may be willing to receive a formal legal request from the sending country to say...
MLA, would then come in at that point.
So they found the house, they've responded, they say, we found the house. And then the sending country is likely to send an MLA request that says, please, can you freeze that house? And then over the course of, you know, quite a lot of months or maybe even years, the process of seizing that and the process going back to the first country will start. Sometimes the country will launch its own investigation, as you said. They may say, well, actually, because that house is here, we've now got evidence of money laundering, or at least intelligence of money laundering in our jurisdiction. So we're going to do some more investigations around that person and how that house came to be. So there's probably 196 answers to that question. As I said, our role is very much to help them find the information and help them find the leads. And then we're not just going to step away. If there's a need to bring countries together to have some case coordination meeting, then of course we'll do it. But essentially, once that asset has been located or identified or what have you, then it is down to those two jurisdictions to work out the best way of, you know, cooperating in order to take those assets back from the criminal, which is the ultimate aim. And by the way, you asked me about success measures earlier, and just to make a point on that, you know, we're aiming for 500 notices or diffusions to be issued in this during this pilot. That's the ambition, and there's lots of reasons for that number, but a lot of them around resources. But I don't personally believe that just having 500 notices or diffusions sent is a success metric. It's good, but it's not good enough. You know, what I want is as many countries as possible involved in it. So I want countries from every region to be sending them, receiving them, responding to them. And most crucially, I want assets to be found that wouldn't have been found otherwise. Now, you know, right now on the day we're talking, I can't give you updates on how that's going. That will come in the coming weeks, I think. But suffice to say, I do believe that we're showing some success, and I'm really pretty positive about how it's going. But like I said, my success metric is not 500 notices being sent. it's finding assets and depriving the criminals of those assets as a result of a silver notice or a silver diffusion.
You've teed me up perfectly for the next question that I was going to try and weave in, and now I can just sort of come out and ask it. And it is, it's effectiveness. Yep. I mean, you talked about the infamous sort of 1% stat, and I think it is important to set context around that. If the asset seizure is the downstream part, you can't seize assets from someone if you don't know about them and if you haven't either prosecuted them or got a court order. So I'm often sort of acutely aware that, you know, to disclaim the 1%, as in, it's easy to think it's a failing in asset recovery, but it's like I think about like hospital waiting lists. You can criticize the hospital waiting list, but what about the people that don't even turn up at the hospital? And we're not able to track the cases we don't go after as a global community. So if we have all of these suspected money laundering cases, for example, and for a multitude of reasons, they're not even investigated in the first place. Well, then the starting point, it's not 1% of 100% of all cases. It's the 1% of the very small amount of cases that are actually taken on and adopted and investigated. So with that being said, I mean, I hear about Silver Notice. You know, again, sounds to me like an incredible piece of infrastructure that once again, we have all the plumbing. Once again, we have all of the potential. And with the right enthused practitioners and the right political will, these things can all be potentially great. But there's always that risk that we keep coming back to the same sort of position where how do we track effectiveness? And you perfectly sort of teed it up by saying issuing 500 notices is not success. No, dismantling OCGs, to being able to recover assets, get money back to victims, money back to countries, that will be success. You can take the fifth on this, and I'm not trying to be scandalous. I'm just thinking practically. We've always talked about the struggles of how do you measure effectiveness, and you know, what does FATF do? And it sounds to me like there's a perfect opportunity here as a marriage between if I turn up as a FATF evaluator and I say, great, let me see how you've done on the silver notices. Yep. Because I know you have intelligence. Like there's no country in the world that would say, oh, you've sent me something about a citizen. Oh, we didn't know anything about that guy. Yeah. I find that hard to believe. And it's like, well, so even tracking through, because that was always before the Silver Notice, our thing as a company and as practitioners, we were always saying, tracking things like the seizures. Now, and I'm talking about what you freeze and then what you finally forfeit and confiscate. So of course you want to make that, let's say it's like a 5-1. I think in the UK, it's like 800 million seized every year, or seized or frozen, and about 250 finally forfeited or confiscated. So even if we say it's a quarter, so everything we grab, we finally get the quarter really returned and that chain broken. So rather than, of course, it would be nice to optimize and get more of the 250 out of the 800. But I'm thinking sort of bigger going, no, well, I would rather get even more at the top of the funnel. I mean, as someone that's been in this, you know, domestic jobs and international jobs, what do you think is, you know, your views, not that of your employer, what do you think is one of the contributing reasons to this, just, I don't want to say underperformance sounds harsh, but what is it in the system that's just creating the friction that we have really willing officers, we have brilliant financial intelligence? Is it something just as boring as the resources just don't have enough bodies? Yeah. And I blame the politicians for this underinvestment in government agencies and law enforcement, but is that what it boils down to?
I think resources is definitely part of it. There's no question in my mind that the level of resource is part of it. But I'm definitely not only because I'm at Interpol, but just in general, I'm not about to claim that law enforcement agencies or governments should or shouldn't allocate the resources in certain ways, because the one thing I don't understand, sitting in this room in Lyon, is exactly what challenges they're going through in their home jurisdictions. You know, we're talking here about financial crime, we're talking about recovering criminal assets, but on a day-to-day basis there are cops all over the world dealing with murders, dealing with gang violence, dealing with terrorism, dealing with sexual offending, domestic violence, etc. And we're definitely not in a position, you and me and no one else really, to say this is what your priority should be and this is what your priority shouldn't be.
I have a financier in London and I'm trying to find his villa. No, stop everything exactly, you're doing. Exactly. Yeah, so, it's just, yeah, it's so ridiculous.
That's really important. I think another challenge is the complexity of the whole asset recovery process. As I said, I was never a
it's really hard
and it takes a very long time. I was very fortunate to work with some phenomenal confiscators in London. That was their profession, that was their day job. They were excellent at it in the City of London Police, and I know in other forces across the country and across the world as well. But it takes a very long time and it's really difficult, and that's nothing to do with their level of quality, which is high. It's just a really difficult process. Lots of judicial elements, lots of permissions and authorities that are required. So I guess coming back to the start of your point where you talk about increasing the top number, you know, the 800 million or whatever it might be. One hope I've got is that the silver notice and diffusion can make that bit easier, you know, because if a confiscator, let's say a confiscator in my force in the City of London is looking for those assets, the process of completing a silver notice or diffusion template is not that onerous. And provided they've got the support from the National Central Bureau in whichever country they're in, it's not that challenging to complete that and to send it out across the world. We will not get 500 positive replies from our 500 notices and diffusions, but we will get some for sure. And what I'm hoping is that those positive replies will raise that 800 million and also raise it by proportion, which becomes easier.
You thought you were chasing 5 million and actually there's 15 million on the table now. And all of a sudden
So I think that's important. And you also mentioned FATF at the start of that question. And
you can call it a rant. That's okay. You're being polite.
So, I mean, you and I think we first met at a joint FATF Interpol event. We definitely met at one. I don't know if that was the first time or not. But we're really, you know, proud of our relationship with FATF. We've had FATF come to the working groups which have helped to design the silver notice and diffusion with us. So they've been present at some of those expert working groups. We've included within the silver notice the possibility of non-conviction based confiscation. And one good reason for that is because it's within, you know, the FATF recommendations. So we're not about to obviously tell FATF or its countries how to conduct reviews and how to, you know, what to say to the FATF countries that are being assessed. But certainly we believe very strongly that the silver notice forms a small part of the architecture that countries can employ and engage with in order to, you know, seize more assets and you know, hopefully have a little bit more success in the space.
And I think that was the point I'm alluding to around, it is just incredibly difficult. It's like saying, why don't we lock up every single person that commits every single crime? I mean, it's never going to happen. And I think assets always just, there's such a personal connection to assets because, you know, not a lot of people can relate to a multi-billion dollar, you know, Ponzi scheme, for example, but everyone can relate to a drug dealer having a nicer car than you. Everyone can relate to, you know, horrible crimes and trafficking. And I think they're just, and they are, it's the old, if it bleeds, it leads. They are just the headline grabbing cases. I think that what I would love to see is that this only gets fixed incrementally by political will. And I think FATF has all that potential to be that tool to actually say, we have to bring this into focus, and we are, because I think that as someone who works on the ground in jurisdictions that are absolutely crippled because they don't have the resources, you have small island jurisdictions that have multi-billion dollar crypto exchanges submitting intelligence disclosures. And some of those exchanges are trying to work with law enforcement. They've hired no law enforcement liaison teams. Others are not. Others are still masquerading criminal organizations that don't give a damn and just play regulatory whack-a-mole. But I think that, again, you go into a jurisdiction that's receiving 10,000 SARs a quarter and there's two people. And you then send them a silver notice, and it's like they potentially could get a minefield of good data. And then you get the requesting agency gets a bit frustrated with the local agency, and then you get the, oh, that country never responds to us type thing. And I think the only solution to that is if FATF can be more robust in the measurement, it will politically force people to say, we're going to have to give them maybe four members of staff, not just two anymore. It can't just be, you know, Dave on a part-time contract is the one who's getting all of this information right now. And that's where I think FATF actually does have an amazing bit of potential, because the fact is people listen, you know, politicians will listen. And what I'm hoping that we can do in our little corner of the world with this podcast as well, and just as our mission at Asset Reality, is to raise enough awareness. I want to hear a candidate trying to get elected talking about improving asset recovery outcomes. I mean, as a UK citizen, my council tax, there's a little line item in my council tax of the contribution I'm making to my local police and crime commissioner. I would love to see in the UK police and crime commissioners going, how do we make this more effective, and starting to narrow in, because as we've talked about a lot, I mean, the impact of just concentrating a little bit more on asset recovery has such a wider societal impact. I think the NCA did a study on the social and it was the wider sort of social and economic output, or sorry, of impact of organized crime. So it wasn't just the money that was laundered or the offenses, it was the cost of prosecuting that. No, the impact of that guy going to prison and what happens to his children and does his family go into care? And they did this sort of wonderful sort of overall impact. And I mean, it's as plain as day. Like, it's as plain as day, the positive impact that could come out of it. But we're also realists, and I don't think this is not going to change overnight. What do you think will be the biggest challenge to this, to successful implementation of silver nodes?
I think it's a really good question. I might start off by talking. So you talked about, you know, FATF and political will, etc. You'll understand. I'm not going to comment on that because that's not my place to do. But one thing that's important for me, I think, is that, you know, one of the things we do, we've got a really good team of analysts here, and what we're consistently doing is trying to identify the scale of the threat in certain areas, and we do that in a range of ways. But if we can, on the one hand, continue to demonstrate the scale of the issue, you know, the 1% issue or whatever the number might be, and also demonstrate that there is a potential, I'm not going to call it a solution, but part of a solution in the silver notice, that's going to be good. What's really important for me is that over the coming months, I'm hoping that we can get some really solid stories out to demonstrate in reality how this works. You know, so if I can make public stories of assets being found and being returned to countries that wouldn't have been otherwise, I feel like that is positive pressure, if you like, that may impact resourcing decisions and may impact all sorts of things that have a benefit on asset recovery. If we can show that a small country or a medium-sized country has recovered money, for instance, stolen from it by means of corruption, and that money can then go back into the public good, then that's something which is really positive and something which might start to kind of to push that needle. I think in terms of challenges, I at the moment, I'm really positive about this. It's not an easy process, as I said at the start, to create a new new notice, even in a pilot phase. I'm very positive about how it's gone so far, and we're not seeing huge problems, I think. What I would say, I guess, is that we've got 196 countries, and if the pilot continues, and if it's successful, which is obviously, you know, my really strong hope, then we will have to make sure that we deliver really good awareness raising and explanations to all 196 countries. We've done a really good job so far of explaining to the 51 who are in the pilot, this is how you can make use of this is how you can support each other with it. We will have to make sure that we can do the same for 196 countries if this notice and diffusion becomes a permanent tool. I'm not going to prejudge. I'm not going to say it will become a permanent tool. Certainly, I hope that we are successful and that proves the kind of thing that our member countries are interested in. But if so, then that will be the thing. It's the scale of the challenges, 196 countries, and really explaining the benefits and the mechanisms of how to use it, why to use it, when to use it. But as I said, we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves because at the moment we've got a well-running pilot with 51 countries really positively engaged, and my goal for the next few months is to keep that going, to make sure that we keep the level of success, hopefully to broadcast some success publicly as well if that's possible, and then we'll take the next step. So yeah, not the best answer because the challenge isn't a challenge yet, but it might be in the future.
No, it's perfect. And is it publicly known? Is there a timetable for the pilot, or is it just watch this space?
I think it's probably a watch this space. We've got lots of really logical and decent governance procedures. So, for instance, our next big set piece event is the General Assembly in Morocco in November. So there'll be more at that event. But yeah, not the kind of thing for me to go into now. But you know, lots of steps for us to take. Yeah.
Being mindful of your time, I think that that's a brilliant point for us to conclude on, is that, and it's my takeaway, which I completely agree with you, and I've said this repeatedly at different talks, it is the return on investment. I mean, we talk about that political will. If you're a police chief or an attorney general and you see that you've engaged with the process and now not only have you been able to distribute assets back, and I think this is where crypto and particularly civil recovery becomes such an important mechanism. I mean, international entity asks me for help domestically. I look and say, here's Nick's assets. And I then, in my own intelligence, look and say, a couple of other connected accounts there that no, the original agency is no longer interested in their, no, their addresses B, C, and D at the crypto exchange are there. And now if I go down a rabbit hole, I can use civil forfeiture powers to say, I have a reason to believe these might be suspicious. Blockchain analytics attribution has just confirmed also that they're in the suspicious bucket. And I can issue a notice to that exchange saying, freeze those assets as well. These, some of the assets are coming back to Nick and his team. I'm going to hold on to the rest. And you have 12 months to come back to me and tell me why these are legitimate. Like, we've been involved in these cases where working with local law enforcement, sending notice to exchanges, grabbing assets. Do you know how many people have ever come back in the history of sending those requests going, hey, these assets that were exposed to dark net markets, we think you might be the owner. Can you come forward, please? No one comes forward. So I completely agree with you. I think that the ROI probably, you know, and the positive headlines, you know, seeing those big dismantling, and we could have an entire podcast just around the likes of, you know, up destabilizing and some of the big results we've seen. One quick technical point I want to just clarify for myself or any listeners. The NCBs, is that someone like in the UK, is that the NCA? Is that the local domestic?
So it's you know, normally kind of a national police agency. So the UK, it's the National Crime Agency. Each one is hosted in a different part, normally in the capital, but not necessarily in the, They're the critical element for any domestic investigators listening. You know, you can't come to Interpol directly. You can't send me a notice. You've got to go to them. Yeah, absolutely.
I was just about to ask you this, you know, to give all your social media handles. And if Nick contacts you through Facebook offering a paid silver notice, it's probably a scam.
I don't think I'm likely to do that in the coming weeks, at least.
The amount of phishing people get from us as Asset Reality, you know, it's Asset Reality usually spelt wrong, and it's usually assetreality@gmail.com going, hey, we found all of your stolen assets, country, if you just, you know, send us a big advance, we'll release them. It does happen, tragically. Nick, I think we'll have to pencil this in for a year's time to talk about all the amazing success stories, but I appreciate the wheels of these things turn slowly. But look, thank you so much for taking up your time today. I know that so many people will find this really interesting. It builds on a great presentation that we had at the SEAS event in the US Embassy, but that was all sort of Chatham House rules, and the guys went into the weeds just in general terms. So I'm really, really grateful for you taking the time, and I hope to see you on the circuit very soon.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm very grateful. As you said, let's hope that we've got some success to talk about in the next few months or the next year or so.
Our podcasts are for informational purposes only. They are not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice. Listeners must consult their own advisors before making any decisions on the topics being discussed.